Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Rufus, why did I just get a phone call from an estate agent telling me they're bringing someone around to look at my house when I did not give permission for it? Well, you tell that estate agent that if they bring someone around, I'm going to shit in every room as a greeting. Yes, I do know there are a lot of rooms, so I'm going to have to produce a lot of shit. Yeah, I do think I can do it, actually.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 314 for the week of August 3rd, 2020. I am Mrs. Macbeth David T. Cole, and I'm here with bumphone Sarah D. Bunting.
Everything's larger in Australia.
Mournful Thompson twin Tara Ariano.
Hold me now.
And freelance gynecologist Christina Tucker.
Everybody loves Choco Bombs.
Welcome to the Extra Hot Great Podcast, and welcome for the very first time, Christina Tucker. Hello, Christina.
Hello,
Christina. Hello, friends. This is a really thrilling time for me personally to be here with y'all.
Yay! Ooh, stop no. it. We're thrilled to have you.
I got a big head now.
We'll soon put an end to that.
Yeah. Oh, good.
We're thrilled to be here to talk to you about Frayed, the newly arrived on HBO Max, in which I will briefly describe Simone, played by Sarah Kendall, who also created the show, has been living in London, married to a man who works in finance with, as she likes to put it more than once, the kind of money that would make you sick. Then said husband, Nick, dies in an extremely scandalous way, as alluded to in Sarah's intro. I was going to be discreet about it. Sarah, not so much.
Bumphone right up top.
Indeed. So then their lawyer tells her that the estate is insolvent and she has no choice but to take their two teenage children, Lenny and Tess, back to Australia. Except it turns out everything she told the kids about her life before she got married isn't true, including her name, which is not Simone. It's actually Sammy. And everyone she left behind in Newcastle is still pretty pissed at her 23 years later. Sammy has no idea how she's going to rebuild her life, but she's definitely attacking her problems with a terrible attitude and generally making things worse. All 6 episodes have dropped on HBO Max. They already aired in Australia and the UK. So this is your official warning, listeners, that we may talk about events from the entire season. So be warned, thusly warned, be ye. Christina, you chose Frayed.
Yes, my dear. I did.
From this week's premieres. And I'll start from a prurient place. As one of your devoted Twitter followers, I happen to know older women are your weakness. There are a few in this show. Let's start there. Was there an older woman in Frayed that you wanted to throw you off a bridge, crush you with a piano, etc.? And was there one or more that you were crushing on after you started watching?
Wow. I just want to say, for the record, it feels really good to be so seen. I feel held. I feel respected. I feel loved. I really loved our main character's mother, whose name is now escaping my brain.
Jean.
Because of Jean. Yes. I really loved her storyline. I thought that she was both someone who was sympathetic and also like working through things in a way that was a little more interesting than just, you know, a woman who lost all of her money and now has to return home feels like some territory we've been treading as of late. And I wasn't necessarily so interested in our main character storyline as I was in like, oh, actually this, you know, mother who's been working on being sober and like dealing with her kind of garbage family is like a really interesting area that I feel like we're not really exploring as much. And if she wanted to throw me off a bridge, I would welcome it.
I found her storyline interesting, the mother, and also
her granddaughter, the daughter of the main character storyline, with, you know, her at school and just being awkward and befriending. Yeah. Tess befriending Abby next door, who is sort of the queen bee at the school. There were moments where I was just like, please don't let that happen. Please don't let that happen to these characters. And so, you know, when that happens, I'm like, no. And I know that I'm invested in a show and these characters. And that's what happened there. I do agree with Christina that, like, and we're going to actually touch on it later in extra credit, but I felt like those two characters, I could have definitely had a show about them, or you know, a side episode or something like that, with no qualms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this leads into my next question, and I'll throw it open to everyone, that, you know, a person who has lost everything and has to start over, you know, whether it's all their money or, you know, a relationship, whatever. It's a great protagonist, or it can be, to build a show around, you know, younger Grace and Frankie, the good wife and the good fight and good girls, actually. but you have to be invested in the protagonist. It sounds like Christina wasn't. Where do we think, if others agree, where do we think Sarah Kendall failed, either in her writing or in her performance, or if not failed, what would have made that character more compelling? Or is that the point, that that she's not supposed to be, and that it's, you know, the people around her that are supposed to pick up the slack? Sarah, why don't we start with you?
I'm not sure where you go, what direction you go differently with that particular character. Maybe that's a failure of imagination on my part, because these are quite expected beats. I was impressed with the balance of the dramedy here, which is a word that I've come to hate over the years, usually because it's like, it's a comedy that occasionally is touching, or like, it's a dramedy, or it's a drama, but it's funny sometimes. Like, just say those things, because dramedy, in addition to being annoying, implies this like exactly equal, like, I don't know, Neapolitan ice cream amounts of each, and it never is.
You are not a crackpot.
Thank you. I mean, not for this reason. But here I was impressed at the balance, that it actually did feel like these are the correct proportions for a show to be classified a dramedy. I didn't feel like the sort of dark comedic bits were ever pushed too far. I didn't feel like I was ever being manipulated into feelings for or about these people. It's like Dave said, like, I actually did, you know, when I'm cringing on their behalf, it's not because I'm being manipulated quite so cravenly. It's because there is that balance there. But the central character is sort of at the mercy of this storyline, unfortunately, and I'm not sure what they could have done differently from what they did.
I didn't mind the main character at all. I just felt like the supporting cast had more interesting storylines, or at least more flavorful storylines. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, they can come in and out with like quick punches, whereas hers had to be kind of a slow burn storyline in comparison.
Yeah.
And for that reason, they could seem more interesting. But, you know, the idea of a character going from riches to rags and having to go back home with their tail between their legs isn't something new.
Right.
And they, with that particular storyline, there isn't like any giant plot point that is incredibly different from previous takes on that. Her character and the small town feel of it works. It's just not like new with a capital N, but it's still, I mean, I was inhaled all six episodes, so didn't stop me from enjoying it, but like it seemed like the least unique thing about the show.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, I enjoyed her as a character. I don't think I like particularly disliked her. I just think they also succeeded in filling out the worlds of characters around them, and those characters felt more interesting. I think also there was slightly a problem with just how many side characters there are. Just felt like every episode was introducing more and more people, and all of those people were like strange and funny and like baffling in a way that I was like, oh, I'd kind of like to know more about, you know, this weird guy who makes great schnitzel who like works out of this truck. Like, what's his deal? He seems interesting. I loved the receptionist that she works with. I think she's really wonderful.
Fiona.
Fiona. She's so funny. Mm-hmm. And I just, I felt like it was less that the character was weak. It's just the people around her stood out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I agree too. And one of the things I think the show does best is give some of the characters legitimate reasons to be pissed at Sammy and to stay pissed at her. I feel like a lot of times, especially in a comedy or a dramedy with strong comedic threads, whatever, they'll raise a conflict between characters so that there's a story about it, and then it resolves too fast because it can't be a plot point in the next episode. But like Dan in this show, for example, Dan, who is Sammy's like high school ex, you know, if he were a real person, he would not be jollied back into being cool with Sammy just because they had one conversation and he's not. Like, it takes several interactions between them, you know, for them to, you know, be even on speaking terms again. And same with Jean. Like, Sammy needs to earn Jean's trust back with some consistent behavior. And then I think it also does a good job of showing, like, Jean had some work to do, too. Mm-hmm. To earn Sammy's back. So I think all of that helps to give dimension to Sammy at the center of the story, but also to make the world feel real and lived in. I thought they did that well.
A little bit of a sidebar, but talking about the comedy, dramedy, comedy spectrum.
Yes.
You know, cardinal points, we got, you know, north, south, east, west, and then northwest, but you also have like north, northwest.
Sure.
And that. So maybe we're doing that. We go dramedy. You know, okay. we have like little.
Yeah, I think that works.
Yeah. I'm listening. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll flesh it out. We'll come back next week with a full dramedy cardinal point system.
With Dave's dramedy compass?
Yeah.
Okay.
I need a graph.
Yeah. I need a graph. I need an infographic for sure.
Exactly. Yeah.
Will do.
But yeah, I also agree that she got too into the world building sometimes, maybe, that she introduced so many characters that she maybe didn't service all of them with the space that she had sufficiently, or
right. So six episode like, run. So yeah.
Yeah. Like she had two seasons worth of ideas and one season that she was trying to cram them all into. Like, for example, with Tess.
Yeah.
There kept being references to her being constipated or having trapped wind and getting sick at school. And she was like super duper pale. And I know part of that is because they're English. And the gag in the first episode when she opens the drapes and the Australian sun shines in, she like screams
like at how bright
it is. Yeah. It was so good. But I kept waiting for Sammy to be told that Tess had a bowel obstruction that everyone was ignoring. And then that never happened. Like I thought I was so smart for figuring it out. And then it just got dropped. So I just that was one storyline where I was like, this just never went anywhere. Okay.
Yeah. I felt like the Tess storyline could have been introduced in the back part of season one and then followed through on season two, because that whole storyline, and I'm not going to spoil that part because it's a kind of a big thing that happens towards the end of the season, but that event kind of felt like it could have been halfway to where they ended up. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, and then that would be the kind of the part of the season two thread.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It was kind of a little too jammed. Because there's like a whole bunch of stuff we haven't even talked about. You know, like there's the MP, the local MP or whatever he is, Chris.
MP.
And his whole thing. And there's a whole sort of like, is he actually taking bribes and all this kind of stuff? Are they going to blackmail him? And there's a lot of comedic value in that. But it's like just one more thing on the pile. Right. And I feel like look yourself in the mirror, take off two pieces, and then make your show. Right. And it was like a little, but better probably that than
for sure
going the other way and not having enough, right. I guess. Yeah.
I agree. So between Sammy's lying, the corrupt local politician Dave just mentioned,
Chris George,
not Christos Georgiakis or whatever his Greek name is. The protagonist's dirtbaggy brother and obviously the Australian setting. Anyone else? Muriel's Wedding's vibes?
Yeah.
From this?
I didn't necessarily put that together until now, but yeah, no, I totally see that.
Yeah, and it's also sort of like, again, on the Dave Cole dramedy spectrum,
canon.
TM. It's sort of like, you know, wherever Rosehaven is on that spectrum, this show is on the opposite part of that.
So on the Dave Drumpus?
I'm not committing to anything on this episode, Neil, you know, because there's copyright like searches I have to do and all that kind of stuff.
Sure, patents pending, et cetera.
You want to get the URL.
Uh-huh,
no,
uh-huh.
I get it.
The other thing I appreciated was that although there is a financial crime element, it was as much financial crime as I can understand, which I appreciated. Mm-hmm. It was not too complicated or intriguey. But it's also as much of a mystery as I want in a show that is fundamentally about the, I regret that I put this word in my notes, but the drama that's inherent in relationships, which are dramatic on their own. And that is enough to sustain a show. I feel like a lot of shows don't know that, and they should. Like, tell the other shows they don't need to add a crime element. Like, relationships are big enough, can be big enough to sustain a show on their own. Anyone else feel that?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think, you know, as much as I love to get into, you know, Billions-esque financial confusion, it was quite nice to just have this kind of low humming and have the focus really be on the relationships and, you know, the story unfolding around them, as opposed to like, what is the financial crime? How many yachts do they have and why?
Yeah. It was also very smart, you know, from a production perspective to have all of that happen off screen. Like, you don't ever have to see them. Very cost effective.
Very cost effective.
In these two sets, basically.
Yeah. How did you guys feel about the 80s-ness of it all?
I feel like there is a temptation, especially now in 2020, that a show that's set in the 80s, perhaps with a lot of talent that didn't live through the 80s, where everything is going to be grid lines and hot pink and sort of the that aesthetic that has come in the popular culture to represent the 80s, you know, sort of the radical BMX, you know, aesthetic. So I thought that their subdued 80s look was good, keeping in mind that a lot of the 80s were, of course, a house full of stuff from the 70s, which was their mom's house, which is an important point to make, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the 80s didn't start in the 80s. The 80s started in the 50s, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I thought it was well done. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite get, though, that her pink power suit was, like, hookery. I didn't really think that was the case. Well, she wears this pink power suit to one of the meetings, and everybody at the hotel starts to think that she's a working prostitute in the hotel. And it's like kind of a funny bit that goes on throughout the episode. But like, I didn't think that particular outfit seemed to warrant that.
When she took the jacket off, it definitely looked more skanky. It was very short and it looked cheap. I think that was more what the
issue
was.
I think it was the cheapness of it. I mean, I did think it was kind of fire, but. Yeah.
Same.
She dressed it up well with the gloves. I mean, she sold it at the meeting for sure.
The other 80s quirk I really enjoyed was the brother's obsession with Dynasty and comparing everything with Dynasty. Like, you're such an Alexis. You're such a Colby. You know, it's a funny little note.
Yes.
Enjoyed it.
I agree. I appreciated that it was like on a slow burn. Also that when she gets home, because the airline has lost her luggage, she also has to wear her clothes that are from the mid 60s because they're all her high school clothes.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Which was funny, too.
Yeah.
And are very musty.
Those outfits were cute, though.
Periods. They are cute.
Like, because it's in the 80s, they're like, you know, why do you look like that? Why do you spell like that? I enjoyed that runner, but I also wanted the outfits. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I thought all the looks were good.
This is just a good show. I mean, I went into it. I reviewed it for Primetimer. I had like zero expectations for it. And I was so pleasantly surprised by like how weird and funny it was. And I'm glad we're talking about it. I'm glad Christina picked it because I feel like it's one of the shows that's going to get buried this summer under like the million other new streaming shows. But like, it really is worth checking out, I think, because everyone liked it, it sounds like.
Yeah,
absolutely. And only 6 episodes. Always an easy sell for me.
100%.
It is time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
I'm going to mention in passing, if you are barely holding together your mental health, this is not a show for you, and I understand that is most of us, but if you want to get incandescently angry about something...
You have no concept of the depth of my ire.
Thank you, Dave. Immigration Nation on Netflix. This is the show that the Trump administration tried to have banned until at least after the election.
Fuck all these fucking... and fuck.
This was not rehearsed.
They were not successful, but once you watch it, it's like, oh, I can see why no one who's in this government wants you to watch it, because holy shit. I don't know how these filmmakers got ICE to agree to the access that they gave them. They go on raids. They're in their offices. They are in, like, detention centers. They're talking to detainees. It's crazy.
I'm sure they didn't. But honestly, I think with these people, all you would have to say is like, oh, yeah, we're the, what is it, the OAN network or whatever. Oh, like, yeah. Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, come on along.
Yeah. Anyway, it's very, it's shattering and horrible. I mean, you have to see it to understand what's going on in this country. But, you know, if you can't take it at this moment in your life, I get it. But it's really, really well done and shocking and horrible. On to lighter matters. Coroner, there are about a trillion about pretend dead people cough. There are about a trillion American shows where Toronto pretends to be New York or DC or Chicago, but not so many that ever air in America where Toronto plays itself, which is kind of the only reason that I was at all curious about Coroner.
I think this is the hat trick with Orphan Black and Forever Night.
Oh, right.
Completes the trilogy.
Right. The CW has imported not just from Canada, but from the CBC. Mm. It's a CBC original, which means government money probably paid way more than 50% of the costs of making it. This is the future socialists want. Coroner is about a coroner. For my plug, just kidding. Jenny Cooper is played by Serinda Swan, who's also about to pop up in our canon presentation, coincidentally. She was Medusa in Marvel's Inhumans for the hot second it was on. She's at her teen son's swim meet in the pilot when her husband suddenly has an aneurysm. She's an ER doctor, but of course she is not able to save him, and he dies 3 months later. 3 months and one severe pixie cut later, she has decided to change careers and become, guess what, a coroner. Her first case involves a girl found hanging at a juvenile detention center. The detective on the scene thinks it's suicide, but Jenny doesn't, especially after it turns out there's a second body in one of the cells. And at the morgue, the head pathologist is salty to her because she doesn't have the experience and is trying to make him pay attention and do his job well. And then when she gets home, she actually opens some of the bills that have been accumulating. And it turns out her husband had been hiding money problems from her because he was a gambling addict and he lost all their money. They establish that he took out a second mortgage on their gigantic house, which not cool to do behind your spouse's back. But then she later says he also stopped paying their life insurance premium. Like, really? Just a couple of $100 a month. Just pay it, buddy. You might drop dead of an aneurysm. But
or
anyway.
Your wife might drop dead and they'll have that much more money for gambling.
Right?
Use your noodle, buddy.
Honestly. Anyway, like Outer Banks, this also features a teen who looks so old. Like, Serinda Swan is 36, which is also quite young to be playing a doctor with a teenage son. Let's say they aged her up to, like, be 40 or 42. Let's not, like, they ever say how old she's supposed to be. But the kid who's playing her son, Ross, his name is Aaron Kassam, is officially 22, according to his bio online. I think he may have shaved a few years off. And what happens in the context of the episode, he's in the swim meet at the start. Husband dies. We don't really see either the son or the husband's face in that scene. And then Ross is off screen until the end of Jenny's first day of work when they're at home and he's making dinner. And because the actual age difference is only 14 years or less, if my conspiracy theory is right, and he's acting like very bubbly and peppy for someone whose father just died. I mean, 3 months ago, but still. They don't read as mother and son at all. Like, they read as working lady and live-in boy until, like, several minutes into the scene. Like, she looks so young, they really needed to cast someone as her son who was, like, actually still a teen because it's confusing and creepy. Anyway, other than Toronto signs, actually having Toronto street names on them, multiple lines of trolley dialogue about putting pineapple on pizza, and discussion about getting caught in actual Toronto traffic, like, don't take the Allen, it's why you're late, etc. It's a very by-the-numbers procedural that was fully losing me until Jenny shows up to deal with another body. No crime this time, it's just an old lady who died in her sleep at home, and runs into Liam, the French-Canadian handyman working on the old lady's house, and it's clear just the sight of him reawakens something in Jenny that has been dormant in her since her husband died. And at this point, I was like, I guess I have 15 minutes more to watch these two attractive people. I invite everyone within the sound of my voice to Google Eric Bruno, B-R-U-N-E-A-U. Hit that image tab. Just enjoy a few enjoyable minutes of scrolling. I frankly don't care if you're into dudes or not. Hot is hot. And he and Sarinda Swan have really great chemistry. I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say they hook up in the first episode. That shirt of his comes right off. And he's a handyman, so hell yeah, they fuck in the back of his truck. I will say, I can tell I'm getting soft from having lived the last 8 years of my life in tropical locations, because while I wasn't mad to see them do sex, I was also concerned it looked very cold. To summarize, the show is a fine to meh laundry folding, dishwashing, phone scrolling show. For me personally, it's worth putting on just to fast forward to scenes with Liam in them. Seriously, look up this guy. If you feel he might also be right for you, check it out. It's already aired in Canada, but it premieres August 5th, the night this episode of this podcast drops, on the CW. Yeah.
Yeah, that man's handsome. I just looked him up.
Yeah.
I'm pretty gay, but that's not bad looking.
he's not ugly. Thank you for backing me up, Christina.
Anytime, friend. Anytime.
For my plug, I reviewed Frayed for Primetimer, so we will link that in the show notes.
All right, Christina, it's your turn.
Desert Hearts is a 1986 romantic lesbian drama. It is set in the 1950s in Reno, Nevada. It is about a professor who's getting divorced, so she has to move to Reno for 6 weeks so she can establish residency, so she can get a quickie divorce. She meets a young woman who lives on the ranch, who is a ceramics artist, which I can confirm is one of the gayest ways of doing art there is on earth. They have like a very lovely, very sweet romance. It's not a tragedy, which is pretty rare in our gay media, and it's a brisk 100 and just under 100 minutes. It's beautiful, fun to look at. These women have excellent chemistry. It's also directed by a woman who is named Donna Dutch. It's just really stunning to look at, and I think more people should see it. It is streaming on places that you can find streaming. I think it's on Showtime if you have that.
Yeah, it's on Showtime on Amazon.
Yeah.
95% of Rotten Tomatoes.
Damn.
Yeah. It's beautiful and really lovely. And I just had, we had a lovely, my incredibly gay household had a lovely time watching it last night. So
how,
I want that joy for you all.
Now, speaking about things from the 80s, how did the 80s-ness of it strike you?
Well, it was the 80s doing the 60s, like the late 50s, early right. 60s. So, and as a, you know, person who was barely born in the 80s, I was like, sure, this is fine. This all looks great. Checks out to me. My fair scientific enough. Review of a decade I wasn't alive for.
Yeah, it's like I just kind of assumed my mom was always in a poodle skirt and eating at diners with checkerboard floors in her youth. So yeah I get it.
For sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to plug?
For my plug today, I will be plugging my own podcast, the Unfriendly Black Hotties podcast. Woo! We are a podcast that talks about pop culture, race, higher ed, and sexuality. We have been recording since before 2016. We took a break because my co-host Camille went to graduate school like a nerd. And it took us a sec to figure out what our recording schedule is going to be like, but we are back in the nation of recording. We'll have episodes twice a month on Wednesdays. We're dumb and fun and funny and talk about a lot of silly higher ed nonsense, a lot of pop culture nonsense, and of course, anything that Beyonce releases, we are contractually obligated to discuss. So that is all happening. And you can subscribe because I believe it will be linked in the notes of this episode.
Sure will.
It shall.
Sarity Budding.
So I watched the Happy Endings reunion at last. This is the one of these reunions that I've watched, mostly because it seems like they're mostly for sitcoms, and this is like the one sitcom that I like besides Cheers and the Golden Girls. I'm not watching any more of them either. This one was perfect. Everyone looked good and enough the same. The writers had not lost a step. There were many good groaners about Firefest. Jane got to scream curses in a way that network TV did not allow. She always did have a Carol Baskin vibe. Like, you think the Tiger King joke isn't going to play, but then it totally does. Other familiar aspects include Zachary Knighton not really being so good compared to everyone else in the cast. But that, too, was comforting in a way. So if you were like, these reunions have consistently disappointed me and I really liked Happy Endings and I don't want to know how this goes, check it out. It is good. I would less recommend watching the Q&A afterward. It was better than some of these, but it's definitely one of those where the moderator is like profoundly intense about the show because the show is still kind of, quote, happening for them. But the cast is like, it was 7 years ago. We don't really remember the minutiae. Although they do have a pretty funny conversation about like all of Alex's many takes eating ribs and how they really had to like sort of pace themselves and all these tricks that they taught themselves and Casey, who was kind of new, to like, you know, don't drink the whole glass of juice in every take. We have to do this a bunch of times. You're going to barf, which she did. So there's like some good intel in there, but it's also like there's that like awkward investment gap between the moderator and the cast and creator. And Adam Pally seems to be not doing as well as he could be doing. And I'm going to leave it there. No judgments. Anyway, definitely watch the reunion. Skip the Q&A. If anyone cares about the Cheers rewatch, we have completed season one. I was sort of bracing for a cast death that does not occur for another two seasons.
Oh, it's much further into it than you remember.
R.I.P. Ted Danson.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
Yeah, that, well, he had to become Michael somehow, and that was how. The fear of a gay bar episode was unfortunate, but other than that, first season really holds up quite well, and they make some, like, it's fascinating to watch a property that is this old and still feels in some ways this not fresh, but like timeless, except for Diane's voluminous button arm shirts. And then you have an episode like that and you're like, oh, that's we need to not go back here. I don't like this at all. For my plug, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, a podcast in which you'll be shocked to learn Mark Blankenship and I talk about pop music, now has a quiz element. Mark and Sarah quiz about songs, Mask S with a Q. We have dropped the first episode. It is in our regular Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs feed. It's kind of a name that tune based on the hits of 1991. There were a lot of shirtless leather vests back then. We all felt ways about how you wear band pins on your jean jacket. We talked about that too. There was winning. There were prizes. We laughed and learned along the way. So check it out. Mark and Sarah quiz about songs. That's in the Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs podcast feed.
Fun.
A quick mention that Taskmaster, the show we talk about a lot, is finally stateside, the original UK version with season 8 starting on the CW. And then they're going to also show season 9 this summer. Enjoyable show. Unique premise, well executed, 9 seasons in, still funny. Once in a while, you get a contestant that doesn't seem like they have the heart in it, and it's annoying.
I think there's one of those in season 9, Joe Brand.
But it doesn't really like bring down the whole proceeding, but it's sort of like, lady, let's do it.
Yeah, get
let's
with go. It. If you didn't want to do this, you didn't have to.
Yeah.
This isn't the draft.
But Taskmaster on the CW, check it out. Very good. On this very podcast, next week, we'll be talking about Bake Off. This is really weird. Bake Off alum Mel and Sue in a scripted sitcom called Hitmen. Mm-hmm. And that'll be showing on Peacock stateside. And we'll have fresh guest Will Ellis mm-hmm. with us. And Will Ellis studies a lot of things, but one of them is food writing. So yeah. I feel like we have the perfect marriage of guest and show there.
I love Will.
Yeah. If you may know him better on Twitter as Rad Judy Garland. So nice. Check him out on Twitter if you want to prepare. And he also, I don't want to spoil his canon presentation, but it's a big swig and I'm really excited to talk about it.
And then on the next EEHG on Friday, it's zooming in on murder mystery reality TV, crafting a whodunit style show for the coronavirus era. Surprisingly difficult challenge
but
Sarah D. Bunting, but mm-hmm. I think I may have cracked it.
I feel good. We're going to fix this, guys. We're going to do it.
It sounds really hard. I'm glad I don't have to deal with that.
You're right.
Yeah, it was a challenge, but I'm happy with my answer. You can find out that and my answer, Tara's answers, Sarah answers on Friday on EEHG. That is available to any Patreon supporter. You can support us on Extra Extra Hot Great at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Your support is deeply appreciated and deeply felt, especially since everything else has gone to shit with making money on podcasts. So yes. It's pretty much it for us. So
it really, really makes a difference. And we treasure all of you.
Yes. So thank you very much. And check out that on Extra Extra Hot Great.
Someone else is going to have to read it because I don't have my computer.
Oh. I will do so.
Thank you, Sarah.
Today's extra credit from Françoise is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are on TV. Françoise writes, I often get the feeling that the protagonist of a TV show is the least interesting person to follow. Timely. For example, I'm currently watching Justified for the first time, and I keep thinking how much more interesting this show would be if it was about Marshall Rachel Brooks. How did she end up as a U.S. Marshal? What's her day like in that office of white male Kentuckians? So, what's a show where the creator got the protagonist wrong, and who would you rather the show be about instead? I will begin. It is very tempting to pick Dawson of Dawson's Creek for this, but it's not that he's not interesting, it's that he sucks. So I went with Felicity of the eponymous Felicity because in the beginning, in the first like season and a half, this like journey to self was able to hold its own better against these side characters who were more compelling. And, you know, this isn't on Kerry Russell either. It's more of a like wilting down to breathy navel gazing in the last, I don't know, two and a half seasons. Like, I still love the show. Even season four with the time travel thing, I don't hate it. But Felicity herself is just like, if we're going to kind of collectively agree as an audience that she might not end up with Ben, which is fucking ridiculous, then you're just kind of treading water in some ways and waiting for her to graduate from college and decide whether to be a doctor or an artist, like get on with it. So Felicity is my selection, and it's not that I minded the show as is, obviously, but sometimes I wish that Megan Rotundi had just mm-hmm. gotten her own parallel like bottle series somehow, because I revere her, as everyone knows. And yeah, that is mine. Christina, who'd you have for this?
This was actually surprisingly challenging. I don't know if it's because I am a person who prefers like an ensemble moment, whether that be in drama or comedies. Because I kept thinking like, oh, I guess that's, you know, this person is both, you know, all of my favorite shows have so many characters in them that I had a hard time thinking of like, what's one like person who should just be removed. But I came back to the classic House MD. What if it just like was about one of the ER techs that has to deal with them on a regular basis? Like, what if there were other people in that hospital besides the four of them and Cuddy? Like, what if there was someone else who worked in that giant hospital that seemingly had teaching and students in it, but never a single person in the hallways and everybody had to do every job? Like, what if there was one ER tech who was like, I actually do the x-rays, and it's very annoying that you guys kick me out of my job every time to do your own x-rays. That's not what happens here. We are a hospital. I think I want that show.
That is a great answer.
No, I do too.
Shall I go next?
Sure.
Okay. Well, first of all, shouts to Halt and Catch Fire as a show that did realize it was about the wrong person and pivoted to be about the right ones starting in season two. We stan. A recent example that I talked about on the show was The Baker and the Beauty, which was a very charming show about a Cuban-American couple dealing with the growing pains of their bakery business, keeping it sexy during menopause, and their teen daughter coming out as a lesbian whenever the two titular characters were off screen. Even the DJ son and the main baker son's ex were more interesting than the two leads. It really was a tragedy how wrong this show got it. Unfortunately, after I wrote these notes, Lisa Vidal said some really wild things in a panel this weekend. So she's one of the stars that I was saying was in the good part of this show. So, you know, Google her. She kind of showed her ass over the weekend, unfortunately. Moving on. I'm not saying it's the show I wanted to watch then, but now I want to watch a show about a public high school as rich as West Beverly, as immortalized on Beverly Hills 90210 from the point of view of its guidance counselor, Mrs. Teasley, particularly if they're all rich white idiots and she's one of the only black people that they routinely interact with in their lives or later, as we sadly discover. And finally, I have just one more before we throw it to Dave. This is more a matter of emphasis, but the POV character in Smash should not have been Karen Cartwright.
Oh my God. Cosine.
The nobody
cosine.
Came out of nowhere to be a contender to play Marilyn Monroe on Broadway. The POV character should have been Ivy Lynn, the veteran who was literally born for the role. I put this last in case this was your pick, Christina, because I know you watch this show too, but I'm glad
you
agree.
Know that I have watched it so many times. I so deeply agree with you. Kat McPhee's dead eyes should never have been the protagonist of any TV show.
Thank you so much.
Because she's barely a human person.
Agree. Dave.
So I'm going to throw one at you. Alias. Is actually about Jack Bristow.
Yeah.
And that actually could be a separate series, like a prequel series bumpered by current day Victor Garber, sort of doing it young Indiana Jones Chronicle style.
Yeah.
With him narrating too. I'd be behind that. But
I have a casting suggestion.
Yes.
Alden Ehrenreich.
Who?
Alden Ehrenreich, solo.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, he does look like him.
Big
yeah,
white
yeah,
face.
Yeah. Yeah. That works. Another one, I feel like Randy Marsh is the star of South Park. I don't watch South Park anymore, but when I did, it was always a delight. So if he's a shitty character now, forgive me. But
he was a shitty character then.
But I mean,
I understand.
A shitty character on South Park.
Yeah. But as of 10 years ago, I really enjoyed the Randy Marsh appearances. Sure. I always thought I'd wanted to go deeper on Randy Marsh whenever he popped up. Don Draper, fine character, interesting guy, but I feel like you could take your pick out of anybody who works with him. And
Joan
Peggy works, even though she could be kind of annoying, but like her trajectory is very interesting.
Yeah,
especially for the time in which the show is set. Mm-hmm. Roger, interesting for very different reasons.
Yeah,
even Stan. Mm-hmm. Hell, even for me, Pete.
Yeah.
You know, I love me some Pete Campbell. You know, he's a grade A jackass. Yeah. He's an excellent character. Yeah. So,
what about the lawnmower? Just a POV of the lawnmower for like 6.5 seasons. I think that'd be great.
You know, sometimes when a guest comes and they have an idea that's so much better than yours, you're like, that's really great. But also, you know, get the hell off my show. No, that's
fair
great.
Enough,
the lawnmower
enough.
Is the perfect pick for this. It is time for the canon, presenting this week, Tara Ariano. Take it away, Tara.
Hello. I'm here to talk about the first, and as seems increasingly likely with each passing year, maybe only season of Ryan Murphy's Feud. As the title suggests, it dramatizes the contentious relationship between Joan Crawford and Bette Davis, mostly surrounding their work together on the eventual camp classic, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. But I want to skip past the episodes about the film's production to season 1, episode 5, and the winner is the Oscars of 1963, written and directed by series creator Ryan Murphy. This clip is a bit long, but I can't situate us all any better than this cold open newsreel, clip 1.
Dateline, Hollywood, California. Tinseltown readies itself for its grandest of nights, the Academy Awards. This year's Oscars promises to be an absolute nail-biter between favorites Lawrence of Arabia and The Music Man. But the real trouble in River City, and the race everyone is talking about, is the contest to see who will be crowned Best Actress. Here's icy beauty Lee Remick, nominated for her turn as Jack Lemmon's boozy bride. Skipping the wine and sticking to roses, Lee? Kooky Anne Bancroft, who brought her inimitable Annie Sullivan to the screen in Arthur Penn's The Miracle Worker, will be working a miracle herself to make the curtain in her latest Broadway triumph. Golden Globe winner Geraldine Page out walking her pooch. Will Oscar follow the Globe's lead and give Tennessee Williams' latest muse Hollywood's highest honor? With her ninth nomination, screen legend Katharine Hepburn will not be making the long day's journey to the West Coast this year, as she plans once again to sit out the festivities in her Connecticut hideaway. But all the Vegas odds makers say the smart money is on Betty Davis.
It's an honor just to be nominated. Again.
Miss Davis, do you have any comment on the Academy snubbing your co-star, Joan Crawford?
Define snub.
Next question.
One thing's for sure, no matter who wins, history will be made in 3 weeks when Frank Sinatra hosts the 35th Academy Awards.
The scene, thus set, here's why I think this episode should win a place in the canon. Number one, it highlights the differences between Joan and Betty. Betty, the Baby Jane star who got an Oscar nomination over her female co-lead, Joan, is off screen for most of the episode until the day of the Oscars. Then we rejoin her in her dusky bedroom where just one makeup artist is helping her with her face while she reads congratulatory notes and telegrams. Even the time we spend in her house can't help contrasting with Joan's, whereas Betty's is lamplit and warm, with furnishings that seem like she chose them to be comfortable and welcoming. Joan's is as starkly lit as a car dealership with plastic slipcovers even on her throw pillows. On Oscar Day, a whole glam squad arrives to achieve the look she and legendary costume designer Edith Head have planned, silver head to toe like a silver Oscar. Once they've finished, four-time Best Director nominee George Cukor, not yet a winner for My Fair Lady, shows up to be Joan's date. Joan and Betty's Oscar memories are contrasted as well. Just before they leave, Betty's best friend Olivia de Havilland asks her why the gold plating on one of her Oscars is so much shabbier than the other. R.I.P. the real de Havilland, by the way. She just died 2 weeks ago at the age of 104, still suing Ryan Murphy over her portrayal in the series and is probably in the process of haunting him as we speak. Betty explains that she likes to hold that worn-out Oscar in bed at night while she watches TV and remember the night she won it, how it felt to be thusly acclaimed by her peers, her talent and skill undeniable. We'll hear a clip momentarily in which Joan describes the night she won her Oscar, but in brief, without actually attending the ceremony and sharing the space with the rest of the Academy, she still contrived a way to make herself the center of attention, and with just a little dash of Munchausen syndrome-esque energy, or at least tragic narcissism. Betty is recognizably herself, leaving an authentically lived-in home with a beloved friend who's spent the last several weeks assuring Betty that she's going to win. Joan is in armor from the silver powder in her hair to her toes, leaving an antiseptic showroom with a closeted escort who just finished unsuccessfully begging her not to do the incredibly ungracious thing he knew she had arranged, largely because her best friend has been plotting countermeasures since the nominations were announced. But we'll get to Hedda. Number two. The episode also dramatizes the way Betty and Joan are identical. I've talked before on this podcast about the prof I had as an undergrad who taught us about identity and opposition in Shakespearean heroes and villains, because I can still see it play out in protagonist-antagonist dyads on TV now. Raylan and Boyd on Justified, Jimmy and Chuck on Better Call Saul, Hannibal and Will on Hannibal, etc. I feel like we see it the whole way through the season of Feud, but particularly in this episode. On a superficial level, the conflict is jealousy. Betty got a nomination and Joan didn't. But the fact that this is potentially a history-making moment, if Betty wins, she'll be the first woman to have 3 Best Actress Oscars, just has her more acutely aware of the optics, as we hear when she invites her best friend Olivia de Havilland to be her date to the ceremony. Clip 2.
Livy, you have to come. The goddamn Hollywood press. They won't be able to say shit about me if there's another woman of comparable stature supporting me.
Comparable to Joan's stature, you mean?
What else would I mean?
Joan, in conversation with gossip columnist Hedda Hopper, is also thinking of her legacy and how all of this business plays. Clip 3.
Something inside me broke when they announced those nominations. Not because I was counting on it, or because I hoped that it would ensure a few more precious years of work. It was beyond that. Whatever self-confidence I had left was gone. She leached out of me. Oh, God, I can't believe I said I would present at those awards. I don't know what I was thinking. I can't go to that award show. I can't show my face anymore.
Baby Jane has been a poisoned chalice for both its stars. If they were still ingenues, there would be obvious moves they could make to capitalize on its financial success. They're not, which makes both their careers equally vulnerable to the obvious downsides of having co-headlined the picture that launched the hagsploitation boom. Or they were until Betty was nominated for an Oscar. The best chance either Joan or Betty has to get ahead is by crushing the other in pursuit of the few jobs and little good PR available for women their age. And even their opportunities to do that are limited. Number three, Hedda's evil scheme. Betty and Joan's opportunities to crush each other are limited, but they do exist. And this brings us to the centerpiece of the episode. As Hedda sees it, Katharine Hepburn is out of the running since everyone knows she's not even going to show up for the ceremony, and Lee Remick is easy to dismiss as mainly a TV actress. So to deny Betty the win, Hedda's first idea is for Joan to phone bank Academy voters on behalf of Geraldine Page and Anne Bancroft while Hedda calls around talking shit about Betty. Clip four.
Chuck, it's Hedda. I just had to call and say how much I loved you and El Cid. How I adore a man in a leather skirt. Oh, I thank you, Doris. That's very sweet of you. But I really wasn't expecting one this year. Oh, but I was thrilled to see Geraldine Page get nominated, weren't you?
Yes, a concussion. She kicked her right in the head, twice. Joan would have been well within her rights to file assault charges.
Well, I was lucky enough to see Miss Bancroft play it on stage. And do you know, Loretta, her Annie Sullivan seemed even more blind on screen.
Why should she have three? You know the one they gave her for Dangerous she uses as a doorstop? Her bathroom. Can you believe it? That poor Oscar has to watch that woman go to the toilet.
No, Anne Bancroft is absolutely brilliant. Love to you, Carrie.
But when Joan starts spiraling so badly that she claims she's not even going to go to the ceremony to present the Best Director Oscar, she basically bullied an Academy functionary into assigning her, Hedda's plan kicks into a higher gear of evil. Clip five.
She may have been the one who was nominated, but as God is my witness, that woman is not going to walk off that stage with the Oscar for Best Actress. Because you are.
What the hell does that mean? It means Joan's going to get on the phone to Geraldine Page in New York, state, ignoring Geraldine's denials, that her character in Sweet Bird of Youth was based on Joan herself, and get to negging Geraldine about the stress of picking out a dress and representing Hollywood glamour to viewers all around the world. Geraldine still isn't picking up what she's putting down. Clip six.
It really is too stressful, isn't it, dear?
Lord knows, the year I was nominated for Mildred Pierce, I was too nervous to attend. No, I stayed home and faked pneumonia. And do you know what? They brought the Oscar to me. And in a way, it was more intimate, more of an honor. Is that what you think I should do? Stay home? Well, I could accept it for you. It's just down the road from me, and I have to be there anyway. I'll say lovely things, and you can watch from the comfort of your New York one-bedroom.
Sure, Miss Crawford. You are welcome to accept the award on my behalf.
Really?
Well, if that's what you want, just send me a list of people to thank.
Let's try to keep it to three names. Short and sweet, in my opinion, is the best.
I will do that.
Wonderful. All my love to you, Jerry.
Miss Crawford? Well,
Good news. I'm not going to make you put on a tux this year.
You're actually going to let that high-strung show pony represent you at the Oscars?
Well, she needs it. And besides, Hollywood should be forced to look at what they've done to her.
Joan then heads over to Broadway to visit Anne Bancroft backstage at Mother Courage and her children. Anne had already intended to skip the ceremony since she'd have to miss too many performances as she went, and the Academy wouldn't let her designate her co-star Patty Duke to accept on her behalf if she won, since Patty is nominated in supporting. Plus, it would be cruel to do to a child if Patty ends up losing in her own category. Seeing Joan staring despondently into space, Anne figures out a lot faster than Geraldine what the purpose of this pop-in actually is. Clip 7.
Miss Crawford, did you fly all the way here to ask if you could accept my award for me?
No. No, but I certainly would be happy.
But would it make you happy?
Desperately.
Well, then I really hope I do win. I'd be honored to have someone of your stature accept on my behalf.
Thank you.
And then, as if all this wasn't enough, Joan and Mamacita commandeer the green room backstage at the Oscars, stocking it with snacks and drinks she's brought and making herself its hostess, as voting Academy members are decidedly not supposed to do. Clip 8.
Miss Crawford, I'm sorry, but you cannot turn the green room into your own private party. It's against Academy bylaws.
Light me.
That's light me, not bite me, but if you make that mistake, I don't think Murphy will mind. Anyway, Joan loves it when a plan comes together. Number 4, it showcases Ryan Murphy's reverence for Hollywood's golden age. As we discussed with regard to Hollywood, Murphy's Netflix miniseries, The Elegant Yesteryear of the Film Industry is one of his obsessions. And while that project let him imagine an ahistorical version of the business in the 1940s, Feud requires him to hew more closely to real events, and this episode shows how much he relishes it. From the opening newsreel to the Oscars red carpet, he didn't have to cast all those stars for a few seconds of screen time apiece, but he could, and as a fantasy caster myself, I don't begrudge him, to the rising tension of the night, until Olivia finally can't keep Betty away from Joan any longer, and the two finally face each other, for the first time in the episode, and with less than 10 minutes left before the end. There's not much to hear in this clip except the tense silence of everyone else in the green room watching the confrontation, but play it anyway. Clip 9. That's Betty storming in. Joan throws back her martini. They glare at each other.
Good luck.
After Joan presents David Lean with his Best Director Oscar for Lawrence of Arabia, there's a tracking shot as we see that Murphy has actually dressed all the bowels of the auditorium for Joan to walk through, Lean trailing her so that she can lead him to the room where winners are doing press. Maybe it's excessively show-offy, or maybe it's dramatizing how Joan, despite her insecurities as expressed to Hedda earlier in the episode, has maneuvered herself so that she really does own the place, such that Betty doesn't even know Joan is standing behind her in the wings when she loses the award she was sure she would win. Betty's still hunched forward, catching her breath from the shock when Joan glides past her to pick up Anne Bancroft's trophy. The moment wouldn't have nearly the impact it does if not for Murphy's loving and painstaking attention to detail. Number 5, the epilogue that reminds us what the stakes actually were. In the moments before her category is called, Betty curses herself out to Olivia for letting herself care about or want anything this much. Afterward, back home, she tells her still stunned guests what could have been riding on her win other than her place in history. Clip 10.
I just thought for a moment that I was back in the game.
Maybe this recognition could have boosted Betty back into doing important work she could have been proud of. Instead, she was relegated to the prison of late career camp, thanks in large part to Joan's bitterness and spite. What was at stake for Joan that night? Whether she'd get to walk out of the hall with another woman's Oscar. And with Hedda's help, she pulled it off masterfully. But as we see her arrive back at her sterile house, dropped off by the driver she demanded the Academy provide, sit down on her bed and regard that Oscar sitting next to the one she rightfully won, we can tell all the trouble she went to has ultimately brought her no joy. If their situations were reversed, one can imagine Betty celebrating Joan's defeat with a lot more spiteful pleasure. And the winner is, the Oscars of 1963, has everything. Iconic actress stunt casting, period gowns, period wigs, an extremely elaborate and malicious scheme, an in-depth look at how your Oscar sausage is made. For me, it was the high point of an extremely fascinating miniseries. I hope you will agree, and that Price Waterhouse will soon be able to report that you have voted it into the canon.
All right. So, Christina, would you like to go first?
I would love to go first. I do feel as though I need to eat a small amount of crow, as when I chose this episode for the canon, and I said, why on earth is this in here? This is such a baffling choice. And Tara said, haha, I picked it. You will see. And watching it, I felt injected with the rush of joy that only Ryan Murphy can really provide for me. Ryan and I seem to share a fondness for women over 50 doing dramatic things in various costumes. And honestly, the joy I felt watching this entirely over the top, that shot where Jessica Lange drops her cigarette and stubs it out on the stage floor before she glides past Susan Sarandon to grab that Oscar that, let's not forget, is not in fact hers, just truly felt like I had done poppers, I guess, in honor of Ryan. I guess I'll have to say it felt like poppers to me. I had such a fun time watching this. I think it's such a brilliant episode of this show that is, in my recollection, middling, but also now I need to revisit clearly the whole season because I had such a good time watching it. So to you, Tara, I say, I apologize for doubting you. And I would vote, hell yeah, this camp ass stuff needs to be in the canon.
Thank you.
Sarah.
I watched the first episode of this season, put it aside, thinking I would get back to it, and just didn't or haven't. That will be remedied sooner rather than later. Poppers is an outstanding comparison, but in my notes, I said, like, watching this is like the visual equivalent of what happens to my salivary glands when I eat a Sour Patch Kid. Like, there is just an extremely, like, sharp, but also, like, just this flood of sharp joy that, everything is working perfectly. Like, this is the Ryan Murphyist in all the best ways. And there's so many little throwaway things that are also perfect. Like, if it hadn't already won me over in like the first 3 minutes, the introduction of Bob Stack and Mrs. Stack, it was like, oh, thank you. So talk about feeling seen. Hey, buddies. Bambi the Chihuahua 2020, obviously, that Betty and Livy are in some like down market green room. And they're like, well, you know, if this is supposed to be a celebration, where's the booze? And like, Frank probably drank it all. Like, yeah, he probably did. historically accurate. But it's just like, it's mouthwatering to look at. And Susan Sarandon in particular just has this, Betty Davis had a way about her, this like heaviness that occasionally there would be this burst of desperate energy, but always that weightiness. And Sarandon really gets at that. And this Joan Crawford is amazing. There's so many good lines. I mean, this was such a pleasure to watch. And I was reminded again that I am really glad that Ryan Murphy exists, because even when it's just like outre and all falling apart, it's still fascinating. But when the center holds, it's so good. And there's nothing else quite like it. So I am not in a feud with this episode or this presentation. Dave.
I enjoyed how Ryan Murphy managed to put not only a whole bunch of 50s sets in there, but had a narration device where he got to put a whole bunch of 70s stuff in there with the interview looking back on the events that this episode is chronicling. So, I mean, that was kind of fun with that hideous Chesterfield with the round cushions and kind of gold. I don't even know what that fabric is, but you know, that kind of glittery kind of.
Well, that's what Olivia de Havilland was suing him about, because she never gave any interview like that.
Okay. All right.
If her estate gets that couch in the settlement, I hope they give it to me, because into it.
Would you enjoy the couch with the plastic coverings as well, Sarah?
No, I would not. Even I am not that old.
If she gets Catherine Zeta-Jones in the settlement, I hope I get that. I hope they give her to me.
Anybody else here actually know people with plastic covering sofas back in the day?
Yeah, my grandparents definitely had it.
Yeah, okay. All right, good. I'm glad. Anyways, the hallway scene that we were talking about, you know, where she sort of goes from stage back to the photo room.
Joan Fellas?
Really want, no, not Goodfellas, Daredevil. I really wanted Daredevil to show up and start, or have Jessica Lange start doing the Daredevil stuff where she's flipping over people and punching people and batoning people. That's a separate show, more for me than was delivered, but.
Yeah, I'm going to pass on that, I think.
Dim the lights a bit, you know, and put on the mask and let's go crazy. You're talking about how powerful the scene was where she snubs out the cigarette before leaving backstage. The other part of that is when Betty Davis is like almost hyperventilating after, and they like cut to all the photo bulbs going off. It was a very, I thought that was a very well managed transition, and it was pretty powerful. I think I enjoyed Hollywood a lot more than I enjoyed this. I think the pace of Hollywood spoke more to me, and it was campier. Like, I thought this episode's pace, and I think it might be a function of me having watched Hollywood, but also like that Good Wife episode where it was so like,
we just did for the canon.
Yeah. One we just did for the canon with all the sort of the back and forth, the tit for tat stuff. This had a similar structure to it, kind of. Or at least the scheming of it.
Well, it was also heisty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it didn't quite move as quite as fast. And I was kind of like, I was that kid on the mechanical horse trying to make it go faster than it actually was, you know, outside of the grocery store. I kind of felt like that. I wanted it to move a little faster than it did, but it wasn't like slow. But I just felt like it was one of those things where I was just like, a little bit faster, please. I knew nothing about this. I still haven't seen that movie, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Never seen it. Never seen Mummy Dearest. I like know them through pop culture, I feel.
We get it. You're a stranger.
Brave. Very brave.
No, I just, you know. Yeah. Well, yeah, I am. But that's not the reason why.
Right.
You know. But there was a certain like unbelievability to Joan Crawford would go to those lengths to get one more spotlight is like unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know any of that.
Right.
And that was kind of fun to see like, holy shit, how narcissistic can one person be before 2016?
I would say this wasn't even the nadir, but
oh no,
Mommy Dearest.
To also like craft that scheme was kind of impressive. Like, you know, like to go through all that and to manipulate these young actresses to give up their chance to actually, you know, do an acceptance speech was, you know, it was kind of fun. So I enjoyed it. I just wish it was like a little bit peppier.
Right.
But it was good. I enjoyed it. So with that, let us put it to the official vote. Christina, what vote you?
Hell yeah. Gay drama.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Two words. Yes. Yes.
I enjoyed it. But I'm going to give it a marginal no. I don't think it was quite what I was looking for. But it doesn't matter, Dave, because 2-1, that means that. Feud, Season 1, Episode 5, and the winner is... the Oscars of 1963. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
and will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser Week. Tara has the winner.
Speaking of gay drama, just kidding. This is the straightest drama. There was rumored all over the end of last week that Claire Crawley, famously the oldest bachelorette in bachelorette history, may have quit her season early, possibly because she like just fell in love with someone really, really quickly and didn't feel it was fair to keep playing out the string with all the other guys, and that she had been replaced by another former bachelor person named Tayshia Adams. And then just today, as we're recording this, People has confirmed it. It is true. So apparently it's going to start out with Claire, and then at some point Tayshia is going to take over. So my goodness, that's unprecedented, and it really will be the most dramatic season in Bachelorette history, and historic, because Tayshia is, you know, going to be only the second non-white Bachelorette in Bachelorette history. So, you know, good luck to everyone there. And I also wanted to mention this just as an honorable mention, in case Christina had any thoughts about this, that after posting a spectacular thirst trap in her pool, Martha Stewart has reportedly, according to her, received 14 marriage proposals. Christina, any comment?
I would like to let it be known on the record that I was sent this by at least 6 people on Instagram, and Martha is correct, because I personally sent her 14 marriage proposals, so can confirm all of those details.
Thank you very much. Sarah.
I wish we were going out on that note, but alas, we have a loser, and it's Harry Shearer, who is taking a weird stand against the decision by The Simpsons to stop having white actors voice black characters and characters of color. Basically, his argument, if you can call it that, is that he's an actor and his job is to be someone else, which, okay. Also, I have a couple of alsos. First, also, I'll put a link in the show notes. The picture they use of him, he looks like the biggest, like, jazz grandpa crackpot, like the scarf alone. But then the hair.
Yeah, it's like, not an accident what they chose.
Is that like stitched into the hat? It's bad.
It's real bad.
My second also is, and I meant to go and check this before we recorded, but I failed to. I feel like he has complained about at length repeatedly in the Saturday Night Live oral history. Am I remembering that correctly? As being this like humorless.
Oh, that people complained about him. I don't recall that either.
Okay. I will look it up, or listeners, specifically Monty, who I know, like, wears this oral history on his heart. Someone let me know if I'm correct. I will look it up also. But yeah, Harry Shearer, no. Also, get a haircut.
Yeah.
I just looked up that photo.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, do the same thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like Van Morrison meets Keith Richards.
Yeah.
Make sure you include this in the show notes, Sarah. The people need to see. It's important.
Yeah, if you saw this guy, like, if he walked into a party, you would be like, yikes, I am leaving.
No kidding.
Yeah. Dial 9 and 1, and
yep.
We all know what happens next.
What smells so skunky in here?
Game time?
Hey!
Come on. Thank you.
Welcome back to Game Time. It is a new season. Season scores are Tara 0, Sarah 0, Value Guest 0. Anything is possible. Ooh. Today we are playing Humble Beginnings from Rebecca, who earned herself an extra credit topic. She writes, very rarely is there such a thing as an overnight success in television. Everyone's career. Jesus Christ.
No,
career.
That's right. Everyone's queer.
Yeah, career. That's, yeah.
Nothing's wrong.
Everyone's career has to start somewhere, and it usually wasn't at the top of the call sheet. Today's game asks you to guess some of our favorite small screen stars from the earliest television roles. This is how it is going to work. I'm going to give you the name and the first year of the TV show that was an actor's first reoccurring live-action scripted TV job.
Oh, boy.
Not necessarily one that they had a lot of appearances in. Sometimes it is. Sometimes they just had 3 or 4 and then they were out. Mm-hmm. But that kind of thing. So that you can match it up with something later on, I am going to give you the name and the year of another show that's somewhere in the middle of their career. From those two, you extrapolate who we're talking about.
Okay.
You can guess. If you guess, 2 points. If you get it wrong, I will give you another clue, which is their most recent television series with those same credentials.
Okay.
So first clue, very first, and something in the middle. Second clue, the very latest.
Okay.
Credit on IMDb for television. Make sense?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Yes.
Let's get the steel mill situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting, alas, has zero steel meals. I have one steel meal and extravaganza gong, thanks to last week's non-regulation game time.
To my largesse.
Yes. Dave won the last non-regulation game time and gifted all of his steel meals to the valued guests. So, Christina, you have 5 steel meals.
Ooh,
okay. So get in there, be fast and be aggressive if you know an answer before Dave gives
it. Try not to buzz.
I feel like I should have stretched.
All right. With that, let's see who will be playing first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Picky has determined Tara will go first and then Christina, then Sarah. Are we ready to play Humble Beginnings?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
All right,
yes.
Tara, I'm going to give you this person's first show. The Dana Carvey Show, 1996, and a show from somewhere in the middle, The Morning Show, 2019. So that means the latest show is newer than The Morning Show.
Okay. I believe that is Steve Carell.
Steve Carell is correct for 2 points.
Got it.
Christina. First TV credit, reoccurring live-action scripted role, That 70s Show. Right in the middle,
yes.
Somewhere. 2 and a Half Men, 1998. That's a 70s show. 2011, 2 and a Half Men. The years I'm giving you for these shows is when they first appeared.
Got it.
Okay. I might need this recent one.
All right. You can take a free crack at it. I won't.
I've never seen an episode of 2 and a Half Men in my life.
But you can just guess somebody from the 70s show and you might get lucky.
Is it Mila Kunis?
It is not. So their most recent credit is The Ranch.
It's Ashton Kutcher?
That is good for 1 point.
Nice.
Sarah. From 1989, it's Another World.
Okay.
Oz 2001 is something in the middle for this actor.
Something in the middle for this actor. Who might be? J.K. Simmons.
I love that guess.
Not a bad guess. The most recent role is Riverdale.
Stay out of Riverdale.
Thank you.
All right. So, Another World, 89, Oz, 2001, most recently, Riverdale.
Luke Perry?
Correct.
R.I.P.
Among his credits, note, he was the voice of Sub-Zero in Mortal Kombat Defenders of the Realm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, let's say he's also taunting Ryan Murphy for reasons no one knows.
Sure. Tara.
Yeah.
1990, Malloy.
Okay.
Followed somewhere in the middle by Ferris Bueller, also in 1990.
Is this perhaps, God, is it Jennifer Aniston? Hey!
Nice.
It is most recent, also The Morning Show.
Mm-hmm.
Christina.
Yes.
1992, Swan's Crossing. 1993, All My Children.
Is it Swan's Crossing? That sounds so made up.
Really does. It sounds like one of those new development road names.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Yes, exactly.
Farmer in the Dell Avenue, Swan's Crossing.
What was the All My Children year?
93, the next year after Swan's Crossing.
Is it Sarah Michelle Gellar?
Nice.
Nicely done. 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting, your first show is First and 10, 1989. It's 10, not 10th. I looked it up. First and 10, okay. 89. 1998, Oz.
Oz again.
Yeah, giving people.
Yeah.
Well, because it's
very picky.
Yeah, there's a method behind it.
It's First and 10 because it's a football thing, Dave.
Okay.
So you're not that straight. Go watch Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
All right. Can I answer?
Sorry, no, buddy. You can't.
Sorry.
Okay. Maloney?
Nice.
Yeah.
Tara?
Yes.
1978, Taxi.
Mm-hmm.
1991, Simpsons, in a significant reoccurring role.
Oh, Danny DeVito.
Correct. Most recently, Sunny in Philadelphia.
Sure.
Christina, first role, 2000, Gilmore Girls. Something in the Middle is Getting On, 2013.
Ooh, Getting On. That did happen. Wow. So many things have happened in our culture, I suppose. This is stalling while I think.
TV shows come.
Well done.
TV shows go.
Alex Borstein was getting on in Getting On.
Is that your answer?
That is my answer.
Hey!
It's correct.
Wow.
Most recently in
I'm a
Marvelous
champion.
Mrs.
It's true.
Maisel. Sarah D. Bunting. First show in 82 is The Doctors. Something in the Middle, Knott's Landing, 84. 82 for The Doctors, Knott's Landing, 84.
Please let the third thing be Oz.
I know, damn it. Oz Landing. Swan's Landing. The Doctors. My mother used to watch that, but I was like an egg. I don't know. Who's going to be Knott's Landing? Jack Wagner.
Your most recent show for this individual is 30 Rock, not Oz. 30 Rock. The Doctors, Knott's Landing, 30 Rock.
Alec Baldwin?
That's good for 1 point.
Jesus.
Tara?
Yes.
First appearance, Saturday Night Live, 82.
Okay.
Middle appearance, Watching Ellie, 2002.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Correct.
Wow, beautiful.
With authority. Christina? First show, Good Company, 1996. Middle show, same year though, Townies, 1996. Good Company and Townies.
Good Company and Townies.
Yeah.
These are real TV shows. They're not just making up.
Then after Townies, there's a really big show, and then there's their latest show.
I'm going to need that big show. I was literally a baby.
Okay.
In those times.
So you got Good Company, you got Townies, and then we'll zoom forward to Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist.
Oh, it's Lauren Graham.
Correct. It is Lauren Graham, Gilmore Girls, the one not spoken about. Sarah. No.
Yeah.
Yes, Sarah.
The Parrot.
The Parrot. First show from 2007 is Caveman. The second show, Children's Hospital, 2008. Caveman, 2007. Children's Hospital, 2008.
Robert Guillaume. I don't know.
You need new material, honestly. All right. Most recent show, What We Do in the Shadows. A reoccurring role on
I don't know. I'm sorry.
Anybody? Know that one? Christina?
I got nothing.
Tara?
It's Nick Kroll.
Nick Kroll. Yes. Simon the Devious from What We Do in the Shadows.
He's just had an Instagram post about that role on Caveman, and it said apparently his skin has never recovered from having all the fur glued on.
Oh, God.
I mean, we as a nation have never recovered from Caveman.
Yeah.
All right, scores, please, Chuck.
All right, I have it's a very close game. I have 8 points. Christina has 6 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 4 points.
All right, Sarah, that means you are in the girls. Right, give it on. If you needed a translation, that was you are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. All right, here we go. Classics. What decade did the action of The Adventures of Superman take place in? Decade.
The Adventures of Superman. 1950s.
You are correct.
Hey!
Sitcoms. What's the occupation of Floyd Lawson on The Andy Griffith Show?
Town drunk?
Not an occupation.
There is a town drunk.
There is.
Then you're doing it wrong.
I mean, hey, if you can get paid for it, great. That Floyd is a barber. I wonder why that's why there's Floyd barber
Floyd,
shops.
That is why. Yeah. Floyd the barber on 30 Rock. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I learned something today.
Drama. What series was co-created by former Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Terry Louise Fisher? Don't overthink it.
LA Law?
Yeah!
All right, you need one of these last three to collect your points. What kids-oriented studio expanded onto its own cable channel in 1983?
Disney.
You are correct, and there's your points.
All right, so how many points did you
get? 3 points. I'm going to split the difference.
Okay.
Yeah. What's the updated scores?
Updated scores. Christina has 6. Sarah D. Bunting has 7. I have 8.
Ooh, close game. All right, let's get back to it with Tara's next question.
Yep.
Boston Public, 2000.
Okay.
The Office, 2006.
Boy, so many people were on The Office. Jenna Fisher? Okay.
Latest show, Black AF.
Rashida Jones.
That's good for one. Christina.
Yes.
You're going to complain about the first hint, but stick around for the second hint, because combined, it's a decent clue.
Wow, to be dragged so efficiently.
Show number one, Dr. Kildare. Mm-hmm. 65. Wait. Second show, Law and Order 94. So, extrapolate what old person was in Law and Order in 1994.
There are so many old people on Law and Order. who is the oldest person on Law and Order, I guess, is the way I should be thinking about it. What is his name? Why can't I remember the district attorney's name?
You're playing the whole theme song in your head, picturing the credits.
I can see the credits.
Getting insurance against robots.
Swearing ahead.
I'm going to buzz you on that one. Here's your last hint. Most recent credit, Grace and Frankie.
Oh, Sam Waterston.
Was that who you were thinking of?
I was thinking too old.
Stephen Hill.
Yeah. Gotcha. Sarah D. Bunting. First show, The O'Keefe's in 2003. Next show, somewhere in the middle for you, Heroes, 2004.
Zachary Quinto?
Most recent credit, The Good Place. The O'Keefe's, Heroes, The Good Place.
Heroes, The Good Place.
There's an actor. Been in all three of those. What's your guess?
Kristen Bell?
Kristen Bell was in Heroes?
I think she was in the third season. Tara.
Yeah.
First show, Opposite Sex, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Second show in 2001, Gilmore Girls.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it Chris Eigeman?
Nice.
You made that name up.
No, that's a real person.
She didn't.
Most recent. I don't believe either of you. Most recent.
It's like, you know.
This Is Us.
Oh, crap.
Opposite Sex, Gilmore Girls, This Is Us.
Oh, Milo Ventimiglia.
1 point. Back to Christina. First show from the year 2000, Freaks and Geeks.
Okay.
Second show from 2013, Big Jump, Masters of Sex. First reoccurring role was on Freaks and Geeks.
There's that. Oh, there's so many people.
Carry
on both
the
of
those two. Hypotenuse.
Well, it's Masters of Sex, so it's Fuck the Two. Mm. Yeah.
Right. Of course, Master of the Two. I need the last one.
All right. Freaks and Geeks, Masters of Sex, Castle Rock.
Castle Rock? Is it Lizzie Kaplan?
Nice. It is. Good for 1 point. Well sussed out. Sarah. 1995, Ellen. 1996, Spin City.
Ellen, Spin City. I don't remember who was on Ellen because who watched Ellen? Isn't that the problem? Spin City? Jesus. Ellen Ruck. Why not?
That would have been a nice pull.
The latest show from this actor, 9-1-1.
Peter Krause?
In the middle, show you did not get, Friday Night Lights. That's Connie Britton. Connie Britton.
Oh, okay.
I always forget about that Spin City thing.
Tara.
Yes.
2001, Go Fish.
Mm-hmm.
2015, Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go Fish and Fargo.
Sure. That ensemble show we all love to know, Fargo.
Yeah. Narrows it down.
Colin Hanks. Okay.
Wow.
The latest credit, Succession. And right now, that crazy music's playing in the background, driving you insane.
Yeah. Shit.
So Go Fish, Fargo, Succession.
God, one of the Americans on Succession. Ugh. God. Is it...
Gonna need a guess.
I know you do.
About to buzz you.
This is hard.
I don't remember. I don't remember. Okay, go buzz me.
Why did you say somebody from Succession?
Because I couldn't think of any that was also in Fargo.
But it doesn't matter. You just say somebody. Who would you say?
I don't know. Jeremy Strong?
No.
That's why I didn't say it.
Kieran Culkin. He played the shitty brother in Fargo that also was a fuck up.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Same character, God. Different time periods.
My God. He did, didn't he?
Christina.
Yes.
Show number one, 1995, Boy Meets World.
Mm-hmm.
Second show from 2012, The Greatest Event in Television History.
Is that the title of the show?
Yes, that is the title of the show. Boy Meets World and The Greatest Event in Television History.
My gut says it was not, in fact, The Greatest Event in Television History. Who was in Boy Meets World? Because I don't know what on earth that other thing is about. So we're going to go with The Boy Meets World. Is it Ben Savage?
It is not.
No, of course not.
Your third clue, latest credit for television... scripted. Big Little Lies.
Oh, so it's Adam Scott?
It is Adam Scott. Nicely done.
Wow.
He was the only one that I was not sure what he did before that. So.
The Greatest Event was his, it had John Hamm in it. It was one of those
really
super
dumb
kind of special miniseries. Sarah D. Bunting. 1999, Judging Amy. 2009, Party Down. Judging Amy, 99, Party Down, 09.
God, what is that dude's name? If in fact it is a dude. I'm not sure this is this guy's name, but what the hell? Kevin Rahm?
Latest credit, Space Force. Judging Amy, Party Down, Space Force.
Hmm.
Although it probably appeared in all three of them, it is not the sun.
Oh, jeez. Emmerich?
Is it Noah Emmerich?
What a stupid
Dave's
thing
still
to
laughing
say.
At himself. Sorry, oh, he couldn't hear you, Sarah.
Your answer was Jane Lynch.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. How soon we forget Space Force.
Yeah. Tara.
Yep.
Good Behavior 96, good with an E at the end.
Mm-hmm. No.
2013, Being Mary Jane.
Gabrielle Union.
Correct. 2 points. To Christina. The State, 1995.
Okay.
Veronica Mars, 2005.
Is...
I mean, the slate narrows it down quite a bit.
Does it? Well, does it really?
I mean, I don't really know the state too well, but there's only like 6 or 7 people in, right?
There's like 10 of them, oh, but there. Only a few that still act, yeah. I think.
All right, so the state, 95, and then Veronica Mars, 2005. Any idea there?
No. Kind of have to be getting that last, that third one all again. Right.
I'll buzz you on that one. And then your most recent credit is Black Monday.
Mm-hmm.
So the state, Black. Veronica Mars, Black Monday.
Black Monday is a show that exists. Kind of where I'm going.
Correct.
With
that's
that.
Accurate.
Thank you. Those would be my points. I have no idea. Who's on Black? Andrew Rannells is on Black Monday. Was he on Veronica Mars? No. That's my guess. I give up.
Sarah.
Ken Marino.
Oh, damn you, Ken Marino, with your face.
Yeah. With your face. And your members-only jacket.
Shakes fist at heavens.
I'm going to cut that out. Anytime from now on, we mention Ken Marino. That's happening. Sarah D. Bunting. The Van Dyke Show, 88. Van Dyke Show, 88. News Radio, 95.
The Van Dyke Show, 88?
Mm-hmm.
Starring... Phil Hartman!
It's a good guess.
Van Dyke Show, 88. News Radio, 95. Most recent TV credit, The Affair.
Oh, shit. I knew it was her, but I just couldn't pull the name, so I had to stall. That lady with the hair from ER. I can't pull her name. Why can't I pull her name? It's not Maura Kelly.
You're close.
When you're in trouble legally, you have to call Dave Cole's attorney, a.k.a. my attorney, a.k.a. Maura Attorney.
Oh,
that's a long walk.
Okay.
Don't you remember when...
Vaguely?
Oh, okay.
Nope.
I got made fun of a lot on that episode. I thought, I guess it just scarred me and nobody
I
else
see.
Really noticed.
No, no okay. One else remembers.
Well, my attorney.
I was thinking Stephen Root that whole time. Mm. Anyway,
yeah,
yes.
I was lost.
Show number one in 94 is Homicide, Life on the Street.
Sure.
Show number two, 2008, Canterbury's Law.
Juliana Margulies.
Correct.
Wow.
Nicely done. Christina.
Mm-hmm.
First show from 96, the one we all remember, Bone Chillers.
Of course. Who could forget?
Nice.
Second show, ER 2003. Okay. Being the year they started.
Yeah. Who joined in 2003 in ER? Linda Cardellini.
Wow.
Nice.
Pull. Yep.
Damn.
Your third clue would have been
someone
dead to
explained
me.
To me.
That
what
was a
bone
hell of a
pull. Is.
That was done. Amazing. I would have gone Stamos too.
Hmm. All right, this is our last question before our second score break. It is for Sarah. Your first show from 1990 is Tour of Duty. Your second show from 96 is Early Edition.
Obviously, this is Mr. Ernest Borgnine.
All right, you can go back to saying Benson. That was terrible. All right.
Wow.
All right. So
she has a tornado bearing down
that's
on
true.
Her, Dave.
Most recent credit is Bloodline.
Is what now? Bloodlines?
Yeah, Bloodline singular.
One
right.
Line.
God, that thing. Who is in that thing?
Tour of Duty. Early Edition Bloodline.
Oh, God. Who the hell? Kyle Chandler.
Nice.
Oh,
really?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Early edition.
Yep.
All right. Scores, please.
Okay. I have 14. Christina has 11. Sarah D. Bunting has 9.
All right, Sarah. That means you are back in the program. Grossworth, Eagle Ledger, Challenge Zone, Classics.
Good luck.
What Dodge City resident said everybody's got a right to live in this town if they stay within the law?
Dodge City. They stay within law. Matt Dillon.
Oh, damn.
I'm so old.
I think Sarah's older than she says she is.
I am.
She's like that kid on Corner. 80s.
Yeah. Who is WKRP's laid-back night DJ?
Night DJ? I don't know shifts, man. Let's guess Johnny Fever.
Should have guessed Venus Flytrap.
Fuck.
That was a 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Drama. What miniseries saw pilot John Blackthorne trying to get a chunk of Far Eastern, that's capitalized, Far Eastern, trade for England? What miniseries saw pilot John Blackthorne trying to get a chunk of Far Eastern trade for England?
Shogun?
Yeah.
Nice.
Whoa.
Soon to be remade with our friend Emily Yoshida on the writing staff.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Thanksgiving nice. Chicken or Thanksgiving turkey cake turkey lady. Cake. Sorry, that's just how I remember. Kids and Games. What is She-Ra's title? Wow, an old question.
Princess of Power.
Yeah, feels very recent.
Nice.
Thanks to the reboot. All right, so that means you get another 3 points. So update those scores, please. Try.
I sure will. Christina has 11. Sarah D. Bunting has 12. I have 14. Still very close.
Very close. Everybody thanks, still has three opportunities.
I don't like being at the end.
For points.
Okay.
Tara.
Yep.
You won't be for long.
1990. Carol and Company.
Mm-hmm.
1998. Sports Night.
God. Is this Robert Guillaume? Mm. Oh, wait, that's not his first credit. God. Stupid.
Most recent credit. 911.
This is Peter Krause.
This is Peter Krause, correct.
There's the Krause.
Christina.
Yes.
First credit. 1984. Subject of the Sarah D. Bunting rewatch, Cheers.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Something in the middle for you. Back to You, 2007.
Oh, Back to You. What a moment that was. Kelsey Grammer is in Back to You.
Sure is.
There you go.
Money Plane star, Kelsey Grammer.
Yes, Money Plane.
Sarah D. Bunting. Boys Will Be Boys, 1987. 2006, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Matthew Perry.
Wow. Ooh,
2 points.
Of all the 5,000 people that could have been. Nicely done.
Yeah. Yep.
Tara.
Yes.
2004.
Mm-hmm.
The OC.
Heard of it.
2007. The Black Donnellys.
Oh, God. What the hell is his real name? Oh, no. What's his name? What's his name? So I'm going to have to say Chris Carmack and know that it's not right.
Most recent show.
Yep.
Vinyl.
Really?
That's what I've been told by the authorities.
Okay.
The OC, The Black Donnellys, Vinyl.
Peter Gallagher.
Everybody's favorite alien lady, Olivia Wilde.
Oh. Okay.
Yep. Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
All right. No points for you on that one. Back to Christina. The Facts of Life, 1988.
Sure.
The show in which you take the good and you take et cetera. Show number two. The Secret Life of the American Teenager, 2010. Facts of Life, Secret Life of the American Teenager.
And not an original Facts of Life cast member, by the way.
Extra information from... Tara Ariana.
Saying.
I cannot vouch for that information. Don't know it. Won't vouch for it.
Yeah, I want number three, please.
Probably hinges on if you know anything about Secret Life of an American Teenager.
That's the thing.
The most recent credit for this actor is The Big Bang Theory. Facts of Life, American Teenager, Big Bang Theory.
What?
There's a big show you don't get a hint for that is a gimme, so
don't feel fair, I suppose.
Super bad if you don't get it.
Yeah, I got no, my brain is, I think, melting out of my ears on this one.
Yeah, all right. So the show you didn't get is Blossom.
She was on Secret Life of the American Teenager?
She played the character Dr. Wilhelmina Bink.
God.
Which is a fantastic name. Wilhelmina Bink.
Josie Bassett is a mom on Secret Life of the American Teenager, Sarah, FYI.
Oh, sure she is.
Yep.
All right, Sarah. 3, 2, 1, Contact, 1980. 1982, Square Pegs.
2.
Good for two. Nice. All right, everybody's last question is coming at you, so let's get the scores, please, quickly, Dar.
It's a very exciting time because someone just pulled ahead into the lead. Christina has 13 points. I have 15 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 16 points.
All right. It's going to come down to this last question for everybody, so put on your thinking caps. Here we go, Tara.
Okay.
Show number one for you from 1982, There's Nothing to Worry About.
Okay.
Except that clue.
Yeah.
Not helping you.
Nope.
Show number two, though.
Yeah.
Blackadder the Third, 87.
Okay. In a recurring role. Hugh Laurie? Okay.
2 points. Avenue 5, everybody's favorite show.
Oh, God.
It's the most recent credit. Note, he was also in Kate Bush's Experiment 4 video. That's one to grow on. Christina.
Okay.
1979.
Mm-hmm.
Guiding Light.
Okay.
2003, The O.C. Guiding Light, 79. The O.C., 2003.
Okay, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good hint.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely a really good hint.
You can peg the age. Ish, probably.
Right. I'm trying to think of who in the OC feels like the right person for this. This absolute nonsense that you have bestowed upon me tonight.
Let me give you another hint.
Fine.
This actor has a distinguishing feature. Two of them, in
fact.
Is
it Peter Gallagher?
Nicely done.
Okay.
Most recent credit was, again, Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist.
Right.
Last question is for Sarah. She needs how many points to pull ahead?
She needs 1 to tie, 2 to win.
All right, here we go, Sarah.
Good luck, Sarah.
Show number one, The Family Tree, 83. Show number two from 2004, Boston Legal. Now, remember, you get a free guest at the 2-point level, so don't be shy.
A show we have now both watched one episode of.
Boston Legal.
A show that had, as we said on that extra that Patreon episode, 5,000 people in the cast.
Yeah, so this is not necessarily going to help. What is the title of the first one again? Yeah,
The Family Tree, 83. Boston Legal 04.
All right. Even if this is not correct, I hope I will get a Dave point for the manner in which I am answering. James Spader.
Sarah!
You are correct. That is 2 points and the victory for Sarah D. Bunting.
Nicely done.
Thank you, television, and thank you, Adam Grossworth.
Yes.
Yes. And thank you, the past, where I live.
I have a tiebreaker here that we will repurpose for a future steel meal. Everybody's free to shout out the answer when they know. Here we go. Show number one, first credit, Girlfriends, 2000. Show number two, Reed, R-E-E-D, Between the Lines, 2011.
Tracy Ellis Ross.
Tracy Ellis Ross is, in fact, the correct answer.
Nice. Sure.
Psychologist Carla Reed and Professor Alex Reed balance their professional lives as doctors and personal lives in a blended family with 3 kids. Reed, Between the Lines. So Tara gets the extra point, but...
Sarah! Sarah.
Sarah. Congratulations, Sarah. Ooh. Well played, everybody. Tight game. Tight game. Woo. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We went down under and back in time for the HBO Max import freight before going around the dial with stops at Immigration Nation, Coroner, Desert Hearts, Happy Endings, and Taskmaster. We had a little feud over feud, but in the end, Tara did get it into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was a winner of this season's first game time from Rebecca. Next up, Zoom Zoom, you're dead on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, Hitmen. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
they should have to look at what they've done to her.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Then where's the booze?
And Christina Tucker.
Sell the shitty yacht.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Are you listening?
No, this is really boring. I'm sorry.
Damn you, Ken Marino, with your face.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.